Those that are staying here, turn to Isaiah chapter 65, verse 8. Continuing on, series of sound doctrine, Isaiah 65, verse 8. Thus saith the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one saith, destroy it not, for a blessing is in it. So will I do for my servants' sakes, that I may not destroy them all. And I will bring forth a seed out of Jacob, and out of Judah, an inheritor of my mountains. And mine elect shall inherit it, and my servants shall dwell there. And Sharon shall be a fold of flocks, and the valley of Achor a place for the herds to lie down in, for my people that have sought me. I want to deal this morning about the special Christian doctrine of redemption. And I'm not talking about redemption in a technical sense, because maybe you know that the technical meaning or definition of the word redemption means to buy back. That's what it technically means. For example, when a store sends out a coupon, they'll buy back that coupon and they'll give you something for a better price or something. We call that redeeming a coupon. Or if you hawk something in a pawn shop and you go and you pay them back for it, you're redeeming it, you're paying them back for it and getting it back because you've paid them back with interest and what have you. In the Bible, there's the word redemption is mentioned many times. They had the doctrine of the Jubilee in the Bible where you couldn't sell your inheritance. You could sell it, but then at the year of Jubilee, every 50th year, it would all would revert back to you. And so everybody would buy stuff based on how many years to the Jubilee. And when they buy it back, it was called redeem. You get to redeem your purchased possession, called redemption. And this is all excellent, and meaning a purchase or a buying under obligation. You've got a contract, you pay it all off, you get your collateral back. That's called redemption. That is the technical definition of redemption, and that's a big deal too. It's just not really what I'm dealing with this morning. I'm talking about the general doctrine of redemption. And we could call it a number of other things, but that is the word that most Christian thinkers have used over the years, centuries, even millennium, have used the word redemption to underscore this basic Christian doctrine, the doctrine of restoring what is lost. Now, when I say restoring what is lost, we could use other words. We could use the word salvation, or we could use the word deliverance, or we could use the word restoration, or reconciliation, or atonement. There are so many words that imply the same basic doctrine. I'm just trying to stay with the terminology that's used among most Christian apologists. The doctrine of redemption, the idea that God has this attitude, destroy it not, there's a blessing in it. Now that's an attitude. That's an attitude that God has. You find it all the way through the Scriptures. Destroy it not, there's a blessing in it. We, on the other hand, look on it as, you know, we might look at something and say, that's just not worth it. You've heard the expression, perhaps, throw good money after bad? You know what they're talking about. You know, you might ought to cut your losses short. You know, you get a car, it gets to a certain point, you invest more money into it, you're throwing it down the drain, right? You've heard the insurance word, they call it totaling. You totaled a car. You've heard that. That's an insurance, meaning you've damaged the car so badly that it's not worth as much as it would cost to fix it. Means it's a total loss. They'll pay you what the car was worth, and that's all. They're not going to pay you what it would take to fix it. And that's bad if you have a car that's sentimentally valuable to you, right? Or you think it's worth a whole lot more than the Blue Book value tells you it's worth. You say, I don't want it totaled. I want you to fix that car. You know, it was my grandpa's or something. And whatever the reason, you just lost it. We would say, total it out. We're not going to invest any more time into it. And that's like the husbandman of that vineyard. He goes over and he sees this fig tree that's not producing any fruit. And he says, why cumbereth it the ground? Cut it down, get it out of the way. Let's plant something there that'll be useful. But then the dresser of the vineyard comes and says, but let's give it another year. And maybe we get some fruit out of it, right? This is the concept of redemption. I just want you to know that now we're getting into doctrines that are really flowering in the New Testament. Doctrines that are sound doctrine that are so much superior to all other religious doctrines that there is no comparison. There is no way to compare any other religion to the doctrines of the Bible when it gets to these types. When we start talking about salvation, you don't find it in any other religion. Now, I realize that our government has to be neutral. Even Jesus said, "Give unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's." He does not expect our government to impose one religion on another. And so they want us to be neutral, and they might see it as a pluralistic way of saying, we accept all religions, all faiths, we're not going to make a difference between any, but that doesn't mean there isn't any difference between religions, and that doesn't mean you should be neutral. That doesn't mean we, sitting in a pulpit in a Christian church, should be neutral. We're not neutral. We know Christian doctrine is better. It's better than Buddhist doctrine. It's better than Hindu doctrine. It is better than Muslim doctrine. It's better than all the pagan, animistic, pantheistic doctrines that have ever existed. It's so far superior. And we would be doing the world a disservice if we did not point out how much better Christian Bible doctrine is than pantheistic, atheistic, all other kinds of doctrine out there. And that's what we're trying to do. Point out to you how much superior God's doctrine is to all doctrines that have been brought about by humans and by devils. And there are doctrines of humans. There's commandments of men, Jesus says, and you've got to watch out for them. And there are doctrines of devils too. I don't know if you know that, but there are some religions that are of devils. Even the Bible mentions some of them. Not trying to hurt anybody's feelings, but the Bible says it's a doctrine of devils to forbid marriage. So you just be careful. If you got a religion that's forbidding marriage to somebody, watch out. The Bible says that's a doctrine of devils. Also forbidding certain meats. Now, I'm not going to get into all that, but I just wanted to let you know that we're talking here about the general doctrine of redemption. The fact that God can look at the world and say, destroy it not. There's a blessing. I can get something out of that. Now, I want you to know that nearly all religions understand the concept of righteousness. I've heard it said that the basic theme of the Bible is righteousness. And you know, maybe they've got a point. But I would prefer to say that the basic theme of the Bible is redemption, amen, not righteousness. And the reason why I say this is because all religions understand righteousness. I don't know of any religious person or any religion out there that does not know the difference between right and wrong and tell you to do the right thing. Now, I have heard of Satanists and, you know, people that have, but I got to tell you, I'm not going to take those little exceptions and try to, you know, throw out the rule. The rule is religion understands righteousness. Religion understands doing the right thing. All, you know, I read a fellow named Joseph McCabe. He had been a Jesuit priest, and he converted from Catholicism to atheism back in the 1800s. And he became one of those old school atheists along the lines of Bob Ingersoll and these other people. Very outspoken, bold, challenging God type of atheists. And he went to the trouble of studying all the ancient religions to prove Christians wrong, to prove that it wasn't the Bible that brought righteousness in. And I read this book on it. It's called The Forgery of the Old Testament. Anyway, he shows that ancient Egypt, he shows by their laws, you'd have heard of the Code of Hammurabi and all these other codes, ancient Egypt had excellent, excellent laws about righteousness. And they had people who were honorable people and good, upstanding people. And I don't know what Christians were around that were denying such a thing, and I guess there have been, because he was very upset about the lies that Christians put out about how it was the Bible that brought about, you know, the understanding of righteousness. But I'm a Christian, and I do not believe that all other religions are evil people. I don't believe that Christians are generally better people than non-Christians. I've actually read some atheists, and they go to a lot of trouble to prove that they're really decent moral people. And they have to do that because they have no real reason to be decent moral people if they don't believe in God or a judgment. But one way or the other, if they do understand right and wrong, then they understand the concept of righteousness. And all of us understand the concept of justice. And these are good things. Justice means the right will win. That bad people are going to be punished and good people are going to be rewarded, right? That's the idea of justice. That right now we look at the world and we say, there is no justice. I'm in the courts all the time and there's always that complaint. There is no justice. I've heard defense lawyers look at their client and say, forget about justice. What we're dealing with here is whether you're going to go to prison or not. It's not about justice. Because, and it's true, it's absolutely true. It doesn't matter whether you really did it or not. Chances are he did. But it doesn't really matter. Because we're not dealing with justice. Justice is coming later. If you really think justice is done in this life, you are wrong. You are wrong. There's an awful lot of murderers out there that aren't getting justice. But they will. Someday it's all going to even out. That's the idea of justice. All religions understand that, and all religions can say that they agree that the good should be rewarded and the bad should be punished. You agree with that, right? I agree with that. I think that's an excellent doctrine. It's just not exclusively Christian. It's not one of those beautiful sound doctrines that we find in the Bible that elevates the Bible beyond all other religions. Because if you're a Hindu, they will tell you, adultery is wrong. If you're a Buddhist, they will tell you stealing is wrong. We understand the concept of righteousness. But what about the concept that the adulterer, the thief, the murderer can be redeemed, can be, say, salvaged? Where is that in the other religions? Where do we find that concept? Now, you don't find it. Now, let me say that when we're dealing with redemption, we're going to be dealing with four elements. Four elements of redemption. The first is forgiveness, which is a big issue. Forgiveness. The second is a remnant. It's a partial salvation. Not everyone's going to be saved. The third is hope. That's a patient expectation, a delay. And then the fourth is the blessing that's found in it. Now, just deal with this in order the best I can to try to explain to you how much better God's doctrine is than all the other doctrines. I want you to know that when I deal with redemption, I'm not talking about the concept of saving the righteous. As in, we find it in the Bible also and in all other religions, good people are put to some serious tests and serious difficulties, and the idea is that the good people should be saved out of those distresses and delivered and protected and helped and what have you. And that's a good thing. That's a good doctrine, and we're all in agreement. Everybody likes the idea of a rapture. You know, where at the last minute, the Lord swoops in and saves the righteous out of their distress and out of their troubles. And that's a great idea, but that's not the doctrine of redemption. The doctrine of redemption is not about saving the righteous out of their distress. The doctrine of redemption is saving the wicked out of their deserved damnation. That's the doctrine of redemption. And that's a huge difference. And so many religions, even Christian religions, have muddled the difference. They got it all muddy. They've forgotten what redemption really means. They're not understanding it. It's not about the righteous and righteousness and the right winning out in the end. That's not the doctrine of redemption. In a sense, the doctrine of redemption is that wicked people wind up winning out in the end. And if that seems like shocking to you and jolting, it's supposed to. It's supposed to sound a little shocking and jolting that wicked people, you've heard the story, you've heard the statement, good people go to heaven and bad people go to hell. But what about the doctrine that bad people go to heaven? If that shocks you, then you're starting to catch on what God is saying when He says redemption. We're not talking about culling out the best. Most people will admit that God is going to save the best of us. Most religions would say God is going to save. If you want to be saved, you got to be the best, among the best. If you're the best, if you do your best, but that's not what the Bible is talking about when it talks about religion. He's talking about saving the worst. Not the best, but the worst. And there's a huge difference there. Also, when we talk about this redemption, we're not talking about self-redemption. As if when you make a terrible error in your work, and I assume that everybody in here has in their work done some kind of a dumb error in a way that, you know, it could actually maybe even lose your job over it. You know, I don't know if you've ever... And so then you realize just how close you came to losing your job. You got bawled out by your boss and they said, you better not let that ever happen again, whatever. And so you spend the next 5 years on your toes doing everything right in order to redeem yourself. You do your best in order to prove that it was just an error. It was an aberration in your normal way. You're really a better person than that error made you out. And so you spend all that time redeeming yourself. That is proving yourself after an error. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about God saving people who do not deserve it. That's redemption. That's the idea of it. You don't find that in other religions, by the way. You only find that in the Bible religion. All right. And there is a difference between the idea of salvage and redemption. Salvage means we see something that is ruined, but we think we can make some use of it. For example, for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been doing all kinds of little construction jobs, whatever, something like that, and repairs and whatever. And whenever I have something left over, I just take it out behind my shed and just dump it. And I'm talking about lots of old steel and all kinds of sheet metal and things like that. And I had it dumped there and it was getting piled higher and higher, and I finally told Deb, I'm going to haul it off. I'm going to put it in my dump trailer and I'm going to haul it off. And so I called around and I got what the prices are on salvage, and I hauled it off and I came away with $391. I like that. This is junk. This is stuff I had no use for, but I got $391 out of it. I find that very valuable. I still got it in my pocket, in case you guys want to pickpocket me. In case you want to go out to eat or something, you say, hey, Bill can buy, he's got all that money. It's burning a hole in my pocket. That's called salvage. In fact, we got places on the south side of town there. I don't know of any on the north side. I need some on the north side. Anybody know of one on the north side? That'd be great. But anyway, we got these places, and they're actually competing to give you money for salvage. Do you know what copper is going for now? $3 a pound! You can sell pennies for a profit. Anyway. That's the idea of salvage. That's making some use out of something that's no good. Milking every last little bit out of something that's used up. Salvage. And that's also a very valuable thing. In a way, I think that waste is a sin. I think if you are wasteful, you are in some way sinning. And I realize that God, when He sends us rain, He sends us an awful lot of rain. It looks like a lot of it's wasted, so I'm not trying to go into that too deep. But in a way, I think some people are too wasteful, especially Americans, and I believe that is in some sense a sin. And yet, so we need to be, you know, involved in using what God has given us wisely, being good stewards of things. And there is some real value in salvage. There really is some real value in salvage. But that's not what I'm talking about. It includes that, the idea that God says, destroy it not, there's a blessing in it. God says, it's not a total loss, I can get something out of it. There's a little bit of a difference here than that. And we'll get into that when we get to the blessing part. It's more than that. It's getting something, it's actually even improving what you would have had originally. Doing something even better. All right. We're going to deal with the four elements of redemption in order. Forgiveness. It implies a real wrong. Look at Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 7. Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 7. Forgiveness, so many people have lost the understanding of what forgiveness really is. The word itself means giving before satisfaction. You give up your rights before you're satisfied. In other words, they didn't pay you back or whatever, you just give up your rights. It's forgiveness. It's a free giving up of your expectation or your rights on it. That's what forgiveness means. It implies a real wrong. Ephesians 1:7 says, in whom we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of sins according to the riches of His grace. The redemption is forgiveness. That's the first part of redemption. To understand the idea of forgiveness, you've got to compare what people think of in the sense of forgiveness. And I hear it all the time in the courts. People trying to persuade the judge to give them probation. They will make all kinds of statements like, I didn't really know what I was doing when I did it. But what if you really did know what you were doing? The idea of forgiveness is when there is a real wrong. A real wrong, not something that was not really terribly wrong, just, you know, have you ever heard an apology where they say, well, if I offended you, I'm sorry. If I offended you. Or if you took it wrong. If you took that wrong, then I'm sorry. Well, why are you sorry if they took it wrong? You see, we're trying to prove that we don't need forgiveness. Isn't this sort of like the bank making you prove you don't need a loan in order to give you a loan? You have to prove you got all this collateral, you got all this money, you got savings in the bank, and you got, you know, a 401k, and you got all this stuff, and you prove that, they'll loan you some money. But if you had all that, you wouldn't need the loan, right? Isn't that more or less what we're saying? We're saying, God, forgive me because I didn't really mean to do it. Let me tell you something. If you didn't really mean to do it, then it's just a mistake. It's not a real wrong. It's just an error. It's, you know, it's an oversight, whatever. Or have you heard somebody say, well, you know, it was because I was influenced by my peers. I was in the wrong crowd. Or was in the wrong place at the wrong time. All of these things are like inducements to get forgiveness. Have you ever heard those kind of apologies? Where somebody comes and says, I want you to forgive me because, you know, I didn't really mean to. It wasn't my intention. It was an oversight. I was impulsive. I spoke out of turn. And all of these are like taking away your guilt. But forgiveness really is not about taking away your guilt. It's not about deserving forgiveness. And that's the basic doctrine of most religions. God will forgive you if you deserve it. Which is an oxymoron. Forgiveness is about not deserving it. If you deserved forgiveness, it wouldn't be forgiveness. It would be, you know, what you deserve. And the truth is, have you ever heard it said, everybody deserves a second chance? Everybody deserves a second chance? Well, not if there's a real wrong. How about someone who sexually molests your child? Do they deserve a second chance? Not a chance. No way, not a chance. You know what they deserve? To be taken out in shock. That's what they deserve. And they're not going to get that. Not in this world, not in this life. Well, in some places, probably in this world, they would get that. And if there were no real consequences, it would be happening an awful lot more. There'd be an awful lot of revenge killings going on. And where there is not some serious justice involved, in other words, if there's not a real justice system that you can count on, there's an awful lot of revenge killings going on. It happens. It's all over the world. In Mexico, there are 30,000, this was before the latest drug violence, I don't know what it's gone to now. It's one of the most dangerous places to live on earth, by the way, way more dangerous than Afghanistan. Which is, you know, shocking. But even before all of this latest drug violence, Mexico's murder rate was 30,000 people a year, which puts it at about six times as high as the United States. They only have 100 million people. We're only 18,000 murders a year in the United States, which has 300 million people. So you look at the incident, and the reason why is because you can't count on the police to take care of it. And you really can't. I mean, if you know somebody came over, you can turn them in all you want. They've got leverage. They've got connections. They know somebody. Something happens. I heard it all the time in the courts there. It was an amazing thing that people could not depend upon the justice. And what happens when you can't depend on justice is somebody takes justice into their own hands. And they're going to go and take care of it. And then somebody's got to take, you know, revenge on that killing. And it becomes the Hatfields and the McCoys all over again. We got a feud going on that never ends. People just killing each other right and left. And that's why you need a good justice system. Don't knock your justice system, even if it's imperfect, if it's keeping us a little bit away from anarchy. It's bad news if you don't have any kind of a justice system. Let me tell you something. Forgiveness implies real wrong. Real wrong and no excuse. If you have an excuse, then it's an excuse, not guilty. That's what that means. Excuse. If you have an excuse, if you have a good reason for doing what, it's called justifiable homicide, right? It's justifiable. You know, it's like when Debbie took the right lane to go straight because there was somebody turning left in the left lane, but it's a right turn only, and you know, But it's justified, right? Somebody's in my lane, right? It's justified. That's what she argued. Didn't work out, but that's what she argued. Now we pay higher insurance. Whatever she says. If it's an excuse, it's not forgiveness. If you've got an excuse, then you're not wrong. You're not in error. It's not a real wrong. But forgiveness means real wrong. And for you to really understand what redemption entails, it entails real forgiveness. A real murderer gets forgiven. A real thief with no excuse. Even a real sexual predator gets forgiven. And you might not like that. In fact, you would be abnormal if you liked it. If that just seemed like, you know, cheesy, that was great, that's super, I like that. That's, you know, this is good stuff. If that's the way you feel, then you're not normal. If you're normal, especially if you're the victim, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. You say, well, now, wait a minute. I'm not all about... You know, it's amazing to me how many people get upset, so upset that they're willing to come to court to make sure somebody gets punished. Victims. Victims do not want forgiveness. Victims aren't looking for mercy. I see it all the time. We'll have a young man. I'm talking about a graffiti case, and I know people get sick and tired of graffiti. They get sick and tired of painting their walls all over again. And I agree with that. I agree. You're tired of it. But, you know, these kids get out there with their spray cans, and they spray their little whatever they think their little signature is, and they put it on there, and they get caught. And I'm talking about 4 or 5 different hearings. You got the victim showing up and sitting right behind the state saying, I want that person punished. I want that person punished. And the judge says, do you have something to say? Yes, I am sick and tired of this and whatever. Yeah, you get it. You know what I'm talking about. Now, when God said, what if the judge says right there to that victim, yeah, well, I'm about mercy. I'm about forgiveness, and I think you're being a little harsh. That won't go over very well. In fact, they'll lose re-election. You want to see a judge really stand up for victims? Bring the news cameras. They will. They'll stand up for conviction. There's no mercy in that courtroom. No, get the news cameras there. Why? Because when you're the victim, you're not all about mercy. You're not all about forgiveness. You know what I'm talking about. You think justice. You think revenge. You think it's time for the right to take precedence. And God is saying, destroy it not. Destroy it not. It's talking about forgiveness. How about if your motives are evil? People say, well, you know, I didn't really mean to. But what if you did mean to? And what if you have such an evil, wicked heart that you know you're likely to reoffend? But if we're talking about redemption, we're talking about forgiveness. We're talking about people who are likely to reoffend. Boy, you're not liking that, are you? I'm not getting many amens on that one. What if you got a really bad heart and you're undeserved? What if there is no exceptional circumstances, no mitigating circumstances, no extenuating circumstances? You weren't in a bad place at a bad time. You planned this out for weeks and months and even years, and maybe you've just aimed at it. You've dreamed about it at night, and then you did it, and yet God says, destroy it not. Then you're starting to understand what it's about. The Bible is full of it. Abraham was an idolater. Bible says so. He served other gods. And yet God was merciful to Abraham. You have to talk about, when you talk about redemption, you'll see it in the Bible. It's all the way through the Bible. And most people, you know, it seems nice when it's just a little story about people in our past and something good came out of it, whatever. But when you really think about it from the standpoint of really evil, bad people being forgiven and being left much more time than they deserve in order to repent and to change their minds and to come to God, and that God have a way of saving them in some way, when the victims would say, they don't need to be saved, they need to be punished. And yet God is saying, I have a little different attitude. Love your enemies, He says. It's irritating when you're the victim. How about Hosea's wife? You want to talk about redemption? What about Rahab, the harlot? You want to talk about redemption? What about David? I mean, listen, David deserved to die. You think about it from the standpoint of Uriah. How about Uriah's mom? Or how about Uriah's brother? And saying, David killed him! He killed him! He had him killed! He slept with his wife, and then he killed him! And God's saying, I have forgiven thee. I've pardoned your iniquity. And you say, that ain't fair, God. That isn't right. And it isn't. It isn't fair. You're understanding what the Bible's talking about when it comes to redemption. What about Samson? Completely throwaways the gift of God and does all kinds, tries all kinds of bad things onto God's name. What about Zacchaeus? The whole town knew he was a thief. And Jesus shows up and sees him up in the tree and says, Zacchaeus, I'm going to eat with you today. The whole town was out there to see him, and Zacchaeus was the one they went home, he went home with, and everybody murmuring and saying, he went home with a thief. We know this guy. He's robbed us all blind. Yeah, what about Zacchaeus? You want to understand, redemption, you have to understand, say, the Samaritan woman. She's had five husbands and now she's just given up on it. She's living with the guy, not even married to him. What about, why her, Lord? Why would you pick her? What about the prodigal son? You want to understand redemption? Read what the Bible says about the prodigal son who threw away his father's goods. What about that demon-possessed man of the legion? What about him? What about Mary Magdalene? It's the story of redemption. This is the Bible. What about Paul? Saul of Tarsus. He tortured people. He said so. He compelled them to blaspheme. He stood there and held the clothes when they were stoning Stephen to death. What about Stephen's wife? Do you think she has a right to complain? What about Stephen's children who had to grow up without a father? Watch their father die. And now God's turned a blind eye to Paul's evilness and says, I'm going to redeem him. I'm going to save him. I'm going to use him. I'm going to make him a blessing. What about James, the Lord's brother, who did not believe, even mocked Jesus Christ. And Jesus appears to him specially after he rises from the dead and says, I've chosen you. I want you. And then he serves him for the rest of his life. How about that? How about Lot? How about Joseph's brethren? You want to talk about redemption? What about Mephibosheth? Redemption. You think there's anything good in Saul's family? God says, we're going to take care of Mephibosheth. Why? For Jonathan's sake. Those are big things. What about the thief on the cross? What about the thief? What about when God, in Ezekiel 16, says, I saw thee when thou wast polluted in thy blood, and I said, live! Live! It's you were polluted. You nobody wanted you. It was a total loss, he says. But destroy it not. Destroy it not. What about King Manasseh? And I could go on. I'm not going to go on anymore. I got three other elements I got to touch on. But if you want to understand redemption, you got to understand true forgiveness when there is no extenuating circumstances and people who do not deserve it and could not make a promise to stop doing it. And listen, if you come to God promising that you're not going to sin anymore, if He'll save you, just keep your promises. Well, yeah, keep your promises, but just keep your promises to yourself is what I'm saying. Keep your promises to yourself because you won't keep them. You don't have the power. Now, the second part of this, he says, is a remnant. The idea, and this is a big complaint against God as well, that God doesn't just forgive everybody. This is a complaint. It's called the remnant. And this is an important principle in the Bible found all the way through the Bible. God saves a remnant. How many people were saved during the flood? 8. That's a pretty small remnant. I don't know if you've read that there over there, but it's amazing. Look at, I think it's in Genesis chapter 8. I didn't write that one down, but I just read it this morning and I was just touched by it. Look at chapter 8. Look at verse 21. Genesis chapter 8. Let's look at verse 20. And Noah built an altar unto the Lord and took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a sweet savor. And the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. For the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Now listen to what he says. Neither will I again smite any more every living thing as I have done. Something in God's heart, after he pulled out that little bitty remnant and killed almost the entire planet, basically killed the entire planet, After he's done, he smells that sweet savor of an offering. And he says, I'm not going to do that again. You know what that means? He's going to save a big remnant. That's what his idea is. He's going to save as many as he possibly can. Now, this is an amazing issue here because it's a remnant. The principle of the remnant is inviolate. It has to be that way. For example, if it was just indiscriminate forgiveness, it would do a great dishonor to justice. That is, if God just said, all right, it's all a loss, it's all a sin, everybody's sinned, everybody's bad, everybody's evil, whatever, I'm just going to forgive them all, forget it all. What happens is justice, law, righteousness all gets thrown under the rug, under the carpet, just gets thrown away, and God is greatly dishonored. God's word is dishonored. Right and wrong, the difference between them, is dishonored. If God were just to say, it doesn't matter, I'm just going to overlook it. Just like if a judge right here in our Great Bear County system were to say, I don't care what they did, let's just forgive them all. Everybody, your cases are all dismissed. Then where are the victims saying? Hey, that's not a good judge. That's not acceptable. The idea of being able to get any mercy at all, that's a big deal. If we can get any mercy at all, and God making a way of making a lot of mercy and still do honor to His justice and His law. It would undermine the incentive if He just eliminated it all accusation, eliminate the law, eliminate the punishment, eliminate all kinds, just pure mercy. All He does is show mercy. That's all He ever does. It would undermine incentives. And let me tell you, it's important to have an incentive. You need it. You know, parents, you do need a rod. I know some kids are so good, they really are good kids, and they almost never do need a good spanking. But you need to have that rod there, and you need to be willing to use it. Because it's what it helps a child. One of the reasons why some kids are good is because there are incentives. And because there is a stick. There is a punishment. It doesn't work if there's no punishment. It's counterproductive. It would not work. And it would cause all kinds of problems in our society and life if mercy were the rule. So, now I realize this is a complaint against God that He didn't just forgive everybody. But you would complain if he did forgive everybody, you'd be complaining then too. There are many complaints that people have against God. That God even requires anything. I've heard people complain that God has any laws at all. I've heard young people complain about the laws against fornication. That I had one young man say, no, I just can't. I can't go with the Bible, whatever, because, you know, I'm a fornicator and I like it. Young man told me that when I was in high school. He said, no, I don't believe, I can't go with the Bible just because I'm not willing to give up my fornication. Don't like God's making laws, imposing His will on people. Why can't we just do whatever we want? People complain about that with God. And the fact that He judges and punishes. Have you ever heard of people complaining about the idea of hell? Complaining about the idea of punishment? They're complaining because, you know, because there's so many bad things that happen in the world, you know, like war and sickness and stuff like that. And they say, why does God allow this stuff? They're going to complain about God no matter what. The fact that God allowed Adam to fail. You would complain if God lets you fail. You know, you mess up. You get yourself stuck on drugs, then you'll complain against God. I've had people tell me, I had this one lady say, I don't know why God let so many bad things happen to me. And so I started asking her, I said, well, what is the issue? She says, well, my husband has left me because I'm a drunk. I didn't have to go much farther. I said, well, you know, I don't think you're being fair to God on this. What do you mean God's making all kinds of bad things happen to you? People complain about all kinds of things. God, you know, there are people that get upset that God doesn't just save everybody regardless and just force everybody to believe or what have you. Universalists, salvation. Let me tell you the true wonder of redemption, that God saves any at all. That God saves eight people out of the flood, that's where the real wonder is. That God wipes out the entire world is not a wonder. The wonder is that He saved eight people. The wonder is that He saved all those animals on the ark so we could start over. And that's why you have all this nature that you guys worship? Yeah, Americans, tree huggers, all this nature you worship, it was God's doing. He said, let's keep it around. We're going to keep all these animals. We're going to keep all these cute little things that we want to save. The fact that He saves any at all, that's the true wonder. And the fact that He actually provided salvation for any and all and makes an open invitation, says, come. Everybody, anybody, come. All of you, come. Come, come. It's free, come. Come and get it, it's free. And the Spirit and the Bride say, come. And he that heareth says, come, come, come. That's God's attitude. How did He do that? How could he pull that off? It's called redemption. It's called God's wonderful plan. This is amazing, beyond amazing. It's unimaginable how good God has done this. And this has to do with God saving a remnant. And He has to pull it out like that. He's going to pull out a remnant. He's going to pull out those He calls His servants, the ones that follow Him, the ones that believe. He pulls them out. He saves them. And it's the best possible outcome. Now we get to a third element, which is called hope. Look at Romans chapter 8 and verse 18. Commentators have real conniption fits on this verse, or on this passage. Because of what it implies. And I can't help out the commentators. I'm just going to believe what the Bible says straight up. Look at Romans 8:18. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity. You complain to God about some of the difficulties you have in life. The creature was made subject to vanity. Yeah? Not willingly. Not because that was what He wanted you to be subject to vanity. Not because He wanted you to suffer. But by reason of Him who hath subjected the same in hope. That last little phrase is what gives commentators a whole lot of trouble, because the idea that God can hope is antithetical to everything we know about God. God knows the end from the beginning. How can He possibly hope? Hope implies an uncertain outcome, and so that cannot possibly apply to God, even though the way it's written, very clearly it's applying that God has subjected the creation to all this suffering in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption unto the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. And not only they, but ourselves also, which have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting for the adoption, to wit, the redemption of our body. For we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? But if we hope for that we see not, then do we with patience wait for it. Let me explain that this hope does not mean wishful thinking. It's not that God had a wishful, an optimistic attitude, thinking, well, maybe things will work out. Like He didn't really know what was going on. No, but this is a confident expectation of something that's going to happen in the future. And if you wonder how there can be an uncertain outcome in God's mind, ask insurance agents how they can know for certain how to make money on all these uncertainties. They know. There's all kinds of certainty in uncertainty. God knows all about that. And you don't have to explain everything. Listen, you don't have to understand logically every single thing. But if the Bible says it, why don't you give the Bible the benefit of the doubt? And there it says, God has subjected it in hope. Is God hopeful? Yes, He's hopeful. You talk about optimistic. He says, destroy it not. There's a blessing in it. I see something. I see something better. That's a blessing. Destroy it not. There's some hope. We're going to get something out of this. This is a tremendous, tremendous, powerful doctrine that God is saying, we just have to be patient. Now, it implies that there had to be some planning involved. And I know it doesn't fit to think that God has a plan B. you know, God knows the beginning. He planned everything out from the beginning. He's all-knowing. He's all-powerful. And yet the Bible speaks of it in some way as a in terms as a plan B. That God says at the beginning, it was very good, and this is what He had intended, and yet it didn't go that way. And so He provides other things. And so it looks like a plan B. Now, set aside your extremely logical mind for a moment and just accept God what He says. He's saying, I'm going to do something even better now. It was going to be this way, but now it's going to be better. So here's the idea that it required some forethought. God had a plan B figured out. He knew what would happen. And there is some uncertainty at the same time, certainty in it, but it also requires time. And that's where the patience come in. Because you can't just have it immediately. And apparently, God has taken a lot of time to set things up patiently in order for you to see the glorious outcome eventually. This is the doctrine of redemption, that God's saying, I couldn't do it any faster. I couldn't do it any better. I could not improve upon what I'm working on now. This is the best. And you'll see that it's worth it. And then, of course, it implies a tremendous cost, which was the sacrifice of Himself, all to have an unforced outcome. Now, this might not seem important to some people, but to me it seems very important, and I'll be getting to that subject maybe next week on the doctrine that'd be the doctrine of faith, that it's not by force, it's by faith. That's just a little tidbit to get you to come back next week. I say, come back and we'll talk about faith. But let me tell you something about this unforced outcome. God is doing something not by force, but by patience. And this is a huge, I think we all could learn that. We all could learn to not try to force things. I know I could learn that, to let something just happen. How does he say it? That the man plants the seed, and then he just keeps coming back, and it groweth up, and he says, you know, it's not how, it's just working. You plant the seed, and the sun, and the water, and it just flowers, and it brings forth fruit, and you eat of the fruit, and it's great, and you didn't force it. You just let it happen. And this is what God has done. He did all kinds of planning. He waits the time. He has the patience and the sacrifice. Now I got to get to the last part. I'm running out of time. There's a blessing in it. There's a blessing. Let me tell you, the outcome is better than it would have been if He had left it alone, if He had not have redeemed or that sort of thing. When we go back to Ephesians, look at chapter 2 and verse 7. I want you to know that in Genesis, He says at the end of the creation, He says He looked at everything that He had made and He said, not just that it was good, He said, behold, it was very good. Now, very is a superlative. It's saying it wasn't just good, that's the adjective, but the superlative is very good. It's very good. That's the way the creation was. But have you ever read the superlatives in the New Testament? Oh my, it's a whole lot more than very. Let me show you something. Look at chapter 2, verse 7, that in the ages to come He might show the exceeding riches of His grace in His kindness toward us through Jesus Christ. You know, it's not just Paul, and Paul uses so many superlatives. He talks about unthinkable and unimaginable and unspeakable and all these things. But Peter also, unspeakable joy, unspeakable glory. He talks about the exceeding riches, the abundance, the overcoming. They have so many superlatives saying it's going to be way better than it ever would have been under plan A. This is the doctrine of redemption, that God takes a ruined state and flowers it through a remnant into something much better than you could have ever imagined had you seen it at the beginning. And this is the doctrine of redemption. This is so much superior to all the doctrines of all the other religions in the world. You need to get a hold of the concept of religion. Let me tell you something. You need to start thinking like God also. You need to stop being so quick to destroy and see what God says when He says, have a little patience, take a little time, be a little merciful, show a little forgiveness, have a little compassion, don't be so quick to judge everybody else. See, when He says, resist not evil, turn the other cheek, He's saying, this is an attitude I've got because there's a blessing in it. Don't destroy it. Don't react. Give it a chance and you'll see what can come out of it. God has the ability to bring a tremendous blessing out of a total loss. Lord bless you.